everyone. I'm Sonia, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Welcome to the Valley Group speaker meeting. Today we have a really, really awesome guest who's going to be sharing his experience, strength, and hope with us. His name is Ken O'Neill, and he is from Redondo Beach. He just had his birthday 3 weeks ago, and he has 32 years of continuous sobriety. Congratulations, Ken.
Thanks.
Yeah, very excited to have you with us. Thank you so much for being a part of our group tonight. He was telling me that for his birthday, his sobriety day, it was very anticlimactic, and he said that it's just not really the same, and that he's used to having this tradition of going back to the meetings where he got sober and taking the cake over there. And just kind of with everything that's going on, that's not really happening. and he said that, you know, he really does that kind of thing for the newcomer so that they can see that this can be done. He encourages that the number of years that a person has sober doesn't really matter. And he says what matters are the actions that we take today. I thought that was a pretty cool little quote, so I had to jot that down. I asked him my usual questions, and I asked him what his secret to sobriety is, and he said two words: let go. And then I just kind of asked him to break that down and ask men. And he said, look, it's in every step. the first step is kind of letting of how we do our way of living. And he said that we need to experience an ego deflation to fully let go. That's extremely hard for people to do sometimes. He said that he had had enough of me being beaten out of me. I also asked him what his higher power looked and felt like, and he said, completely pure, God is love. And he grew up Catholic, so this idea has been with him for a very long time. He said, all I have to know is that God is or isn't. I asked him what emotional sobriety looks like. He said, an ability to not put my ego at the center of everything. To be an observer of what I feel, and he can have an emotion and see it is and not have to react to it. I also asked him if he had any advice for the newcomer, and he said, just stay. Stop thinking, stop feeling. Take a breath, stay and trust us. Look around the room and see how many of us, you know, are here and how many people this has worked for. And he said that the less you know coming into AA, and the less answers that you have, the more likely this will work for you. So with that, I think I'm going to let our speaker go ahead and elaborate on a lot of that and share. So thank you again for letting me be of service. Ken, I hand it off to you.
Wow. Thank you, Sonia. That's probably one of the best intros I've ever had. And I'm really happy to be here with all of you tonight. My name's Ken O'Neill. I'm an alcoholic. And those are probably the most important things I've ever said about myself. Great fact in my life, and took a long time to get there, and it's been a long time since I've been here. As Sonia mentioned, I am celebrated 32 years of sobriety recently. My sobriety day is 4/28/88. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. I think you had some other guys from our group here before, maybe Steve Lamb and Bill Cleveland. And, you know, I have a sponsor named Robert B., who has a sponsor named John McGee, who had a sponsor named Donald Madden, who had a sponsor named Norm Alpie, who had a sponsor named Chuck Chamberlain, who had a sponsor named Bill Wilson. And when I share that with you, hopefully with some understanding of, you know, where what I have comes from and some of the traditions I've learned and adhered to over the years, I think that's a great lineage. And I think that's much more important than how many years I am. Like I mentioned with Sonia earlier today, you know, it's not about me. And it's not about putting each other on a pedestal or a pecking order based on the number of years we've been gifted to stay around this thing. Every day I'm here, it's a gift. It's a matter of grace and unmerited gift. And I'm really grateful for it. So if I'm going to be grateful for it, I should probably demonstrate that by being humble about it. And I can tell you that I've met many people in the program with half as much time as me that knew twice as much, and as many people with more time than me that knew honestly very little. And so I believe that we demonstrate our gifts in this program by how we act and the actions we choose to take and the path we follow. And I'm really grateful for being here. You know, I absolutely love this tradition that you guys have where you have the speaker, the person who introduces the speaker actually gets to know the speaker. That's a rarity in AA. I don't speak a whole lot. I'm certainly not considered a circuit speaker, but I speak a lot in my area, and it's just not something that people really take the time to do, and it shows a lot of forethought and a lot of love, and I just really appreciate it. So the great thing about AA is there is no truth. There is no one truth in our program, and there is no rule book. Right, we have a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but all that is the experience, strength, and hope of the founders of the program. It's their experience. We can't argue with it. We can't debate it. And I always chuckle when people talk about wanting to change the words in it because they're their words, not ours. And so I've learned that, you know, you take what you like here and you leave the rest. You take the part that works. And you follow the path of those who have successfully come before you, right? And what I'm going to share tonight is just my experience. I'm not here. I'm not an authority. I'm not here to tell you the right way or the wrong way. I'm not here to pretend like I know the secret handshake or the magic words or anything like that. Right? I'm just here to tell you about me and how I did it and what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And if that somehow to any degree helps you, then my time here today has been totally worth it. So with that being said, I'll just get into it a little bit about my background and my story. You know, I don't have a real dramatic story, and, you know, nobody was killed and there were no plane crashes and there was no, you know, commando raids and there was no airplane crashes, and, you know, I didn't grow up in a brothel and you know, I just don't have a big, long, sad story. My story of my childhood and how I got here is actually pretty tame. But it was just as powerful and it's just as debilitating and hopeless and destructive as any other story I've heard. And, you know, I grew up in a really good family. The mother and father that loved me. My dad was fairly successful in business. I grew up in a very kind of old money part of Los Angeles. And my parents always wanted to send me to the best schools and give me the best of everything. But the other side of that coin was also that, you know, my parents thought that they were very privileged, and so I grew up within a certain air of elitism, and all my summers were spent at private beach clubs. My Easter and Christmas holidays were spent at private clubs downtown Los Angeles. We didn't socialize with people outside of our economic stratus. And if anybody from color walked down our street, my dad would have to drive around the block 6 times to make sure that they weren't going to, quote unquote, do something. Right? So there was always this underlying air of superiority. My family was actually enlisted in a society register at one point. And I never understood that. And I always thought it was weird. I never liked it. I never liked the whole idea that just because of who my grandparents were and my great grandparents were, that somehow I was better than anybody else. And that idea just never sat well with me. And so I was very rebellious as a child. I never felt comfortable in my own family. I went to a school where some things happened to me that I really don't have the time or the wherewithal to get into, but let's just say by 8 or 9 years old, I was really pissed off, and I was really angry. And so not only was I uncomfortable at home, but I was angry, and I wanted to lash out and strike back at anyone to make the world pay for what had happened to me. And I really took a very anti-establishment view of the world very early on in my life. And, it's funny because I was going to private schools, and I was very isolated and protected. But when I was 11, I had my first drink, and it was January 4th, 1976, bicentennial. And we had just moved onto a new street, into a new house. We'd been there about a month, and our block was having a huge block party, and there were a lot of kids younger than me, my age, and older than me. And at that party, a couple of the older kids came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to party with us?" And I had no idea what that meant. I said, "Yes, I do." And off I went. And I went down the block and into somebody's garage and back by the pool, and there was a 24 pack of Frosty Mickey Big Mouths, and I had my first beer. And I'm not here to tell you that I became an alcoholic with the first drink, and I didn't have any kind of a phenomenon of craving or any kind of an obsession. I just enjoyed the hell out of that first beer, and I had, I think, one or two more over the course of the day, and I felt good, and it was a good experience. And I didn't become an alcoholic right away, and my world didn't blow up the minute I put alcohol in my lips. I gotta tell you, if I'm honest, that it worked for me for a long time, right? But I was so young and so immature and so underdeveloped that I developed this association between drinking alcohol and connecting with other people. And for the first time, my first times, drinking and partying and getting drunk and feeling altered, were all hand in hand with developing bonds of friendship with other people my age. I mean, I did not have any friends before, any close friends at least, before I moved onto that street and started partying with the kids on my street. And that's just the fact. And I didn't start drinking every day at 11 or anything like that. I had a pretty normal life. But when I was about 13, I went to my first punk rock concert. And I got really into the punk rock scene in 1977, 78. And before anybody really knew what it was. And, I was going to an all-boys private Catholic prep school, and I was showing up in Doc Martens and leather pants and a shaved head, and they didn't know what to do with me. And, but it was okay because I met the dress code. And that was my life. I had this duality. I had this anti-establishment, punk rock, anarchist, revolutionary mentality. And here I was, you know, having dinner at the country club and, you know, hanging out with my private school friends at the beach. And I used to joke, I was the only punk rocker I knew that had perfect manners and knew proper etiquette, right? I went to Cotillion. I learned how to ballroom dance. And then I sneak out at night. I go hear the Ramones play at the Whiskey A Go Go. So, you know, it was this, I was leading this dual life. And by day, I was a pretty normal kid that dressed kind of funny. And at night, I was running around Hollywood with my skinhead friends, causing all kinds of trouble and picking fights with the LA County sheriffs and snorting black beauties and drinking malt liquor, you know. And that was kind of my life through high school, right? And it just, for a long time it worked. It just worked for a long time. And as I progressed and got older, every year it was like a new experiment. And I definitely grew up in the age of better living by chemistry. And I don't have to get into all that. And I used to dual identify as an alcoholic addict. I don't do that anymore because I learned a long time ago that, it was always alcohol that I came back to. It was always alcohol that I was searching for. It was always alcohol that I depended on and I relied on, and everything else was just the window dressing. Yeah, if you had it and put it in front of me, I'd do it, but that wasn't made me who and what I eventually became. So things progressed, and by the time I got to college, I was, you know, drinking every day pretty much, and or at the very least every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then slowly but surely Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday got added to that. And then I kind of did a geographic in the middle of my college career. I moved from Southern California to New York City. And it was a whole different ballgame when I got to New York, because in New York, you know, the bars and nightclubs are open till 4. And then after hours open, underground after hours places open from 4 to 8, and then all the neighborhood bars open up at 8, and you could literally get off, you know, go to work on a Thursday night and not have class on Friday and sit in a bar for 3 days with the right kind of stimulants to keep you awake. And it was just nonstop drinking 24 hours a day, 2, 3, 4 days at a time. And I did that for years. And, you know, I didn't really realize what was happening to me. But once I got here and I read the big book, I understood that I had, you know, crossed the chasm. I had reached my tipping point, and what had worked for me for so long just stopped working. And instead of me seeing it as an enhancement in my life, I finally started to see it as a real hindrance to my life, right? And I started having problems in college that I hadn't had when I was younger. And it just seemed like my life never really fit together when I wasn't drinking, when I wasn't partying, right? And so my solution to that was to party more, to drink more, to use more, right? And I kept turning to the more, right? Give me more of that, give me more of that, give me more of that. Because when I wasn't drinking, my life just got more and more disjointed, more and more uncomfortable. And, you know, I realized once I got sober that I never had a drinking problem. I had a staying sober problem, right? I could not go for long periods of time without doing what I had been doing. But I just couldn't see it. I couldn't see it for the longest time. And then there was a point where, you know, I realized that sitting around once again at 6 o'clock in the morning, watching the sun come up and hearing the birds chirp outside my window, I wanted my life to go, but I didn't know how to do anything about it, right? It was all I had come to know, and it was all I knew how to do. And you know, if I'm not doing this, well, what the hell am I going to do, and where am I going to go, and how am I going to get out of this? I felt like I was caught in this trap that I couldn't spring, and I was damned if I did, and I was damned if I didn't, and it was a really awful position to be in. And I got, you know, I just had this constant sense of pending doom, right? Like there was this black cloud that was following me around. I just couldn't get out from underneath it. And nothing I did was ever going to be right, and it wasn't going to work, and I wasn't going to go anywhere. You know, my dad used to say to me, he never came to, my mom and my dad used to always, like, you know, they would try to pump me up and motivate me, and they would say things like, you know, everybody says you have so much potential, and, you know, this is going to be your year. And that was always what I had been. And, you know, I've been this kid with all the potential, but I never did anything, right? And I never understood why, and I never understood, you know, why can't I be the lucky guy where things just fall into place for me? And so I had this just constant, chronic sense of pending doom, like everything was going to completely fall apart right around the corner. And then I started to notice that, you know, I was ending up in some really dark places with some really dark people. And, you know, here I am, this, you know, this anti-establishment, kid from the establishment, you know, in New York City, and, you know, a kid that had watched The Godfather one too many times, is all of a sudden hanging out in bars with all these wannabe mob guys, and they're all carrying guns, and they're all dealing drugs, and they're all doing what I'm doing. But I kept hanging out with them and meeting more and more of their friends because they all felt the way I did, right? And they were all turning to the same things I was turning to. And it was almost like we had this unspoken camaraderie, you know, around just a sense of, you know, hopelessness that led to a, you know, kind of like, well, what the hell, you know, screw it attitude. And that's where I found myself. And then, you know, in April 1988, I was in an after-hours bar in the West Village. You can look it up. It's still there. It's called the 55. And it was in the basement of a brownstone right next to a very famous gay bar called the Stonewall Inn. It was on Christopher Street in Sheridan Square. And I had been in there for 3 days. I had not left that bar for 3 days. We had food ordered in, like, once a day. And I just sat there and drank around the clock. And to make a long story short, you know, somebody said something they shouldn't have to somebody I knew, and they said something back that they shouldn't have to somebody they knew. And before I knew it, on a Tuesday morning at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, here's this group of guys in a bar fight rolling out the front door on the sidewalk in the middle of this huge bar fight with like 20 people. And in the middle of that bar fight, somebody pulled a gun on me and stuck it in my face and said, "What are you going to do now, tough guy?" And my whole life stopped. And in an instant, I knew that everything I was doing up until that point had to stop. I didn't know how, and I didn't know why. I just knew it had to stop. And I had this stark realization that my life was absolutely at a bottom. But I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to say, and the guy who pulled the gun on me eventually ran away. And I stood there for about a half a minute just going, what am I going to do? And then without even thinking about it, the book calls it a mental blank spot, I turned around and I walked right back into the bar and sat down and had another drink, right? And I was so lost and so broken and so upset. I felt so trapped and so hopeless. I literally drank myself to the point where some people had to carry me home, and I ended up sleeping for almost 20 hours in my apartment, and I remember I woke up and I was covered in vomit, blood, and urine, and all the other things that come along with that, and I was really, really sick. And it took me better part of a day to kind of get up and get out of bed and take a shower and get moving again. And I just remember, I felt like I had been in an absolute knockdown, drag out fight, and my spirit was broken, and I couldn't get myself to do anything. I didn't want to go back and start drinking again. I didn't want to return to any other favors. The whole concept of partying was long, long gone, and it was complete and utter misery for me, and I just didn't know what to turn. And you know, it's really interesting because by this point, after all the time I had spent in college, I had kind of given up on my faith, and I had really become convinced I was an atheist. And yet at that moment, I just had this feeling like it was just a glimpse, but it was like, you know, maybe there is something else out there. And maybe I was wrong. Maybe I've been wrong about just about everything up until this point. But the only thing I could think of doing was getting on the phone and calling up my mom, and God bless my mother. You know, my mother hadn't spoken to me for about a year and a half, and she had been counseled by some Al-Anon women that I'll be forever grateful for, that, you know, the only call you take from Ken is the call where he asks for help. So I made that call, and I didn't get an envelope in the mail with some money to buy an airline ticket. I got a one-way airline ticket, and my mom had fallen for the stories too many times about people breaking into my apartment and stealing my rent money, and so there was no more envelopes coming with money in them via FedEx. But I got the airline ticket, and I got on a plane, and I came back to Los Angeles, and I spent about 60 days just healing up from what I had done to my body. I mean, I was 23 years old, and I had pancreatitis, and I had an enlarged kidney and fatty liver and cirrhosis, and I had an ulcer in my esophagus and an ulcerated septum in my nose. And I was, when I graduated high school, I weighed about 235 pounds, and I was 172 pounds when I ended up on my parents' doorstep. And, the doctors that examined me and treated me told me that I had only a few months, if not a few weeks, left to go before all the organs in my body started shutting down. And, you know, and I thought a lot about that, and I was like, how did I get here? How did I dig such a deep, dark hole for myself, you know? But I didn't want this. This isn't what I chose. I was just, you know, I was just trying to fill a void. I had this void in my heart and my soul, and I was just trying to feel better, right? I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I wasn't trying to, you know, be a tough guy. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing any of those things. I was just trying to survive. And so anyway, long story short, I didn't know what to do. I was sober probably 3 or 4 months, and I was going absolutely stir crazy. And again, you know, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a living sober problem, and I was irritable, restless, and discontented. I remember the first time I read that in the big book, it was like a lightning bolt hit me, because those three words described me perfectly, both before, during, and after all my experience. But I just didn't know what to do. And it's weird because nobody ever came to me and said, hey, Ken, you know, you might want to do something different because you may have a drug and alcohol problem, right? You might want to think about that a little bit. And I never got arrested. I never had a DUI because I was living in New York and taking taxis in the subway everywhere. I'm sure I would have had at least 2 or 3 if I had still been living in Los Angeles. But you know, I had no nudge from a judge. I had no friends doing an intervention. I didn't have that experience. I really identify with what Chuck Chamberlain talks about in A New Pair of Glasses, where I was just surrendered by the alcohol itself. Right? I just drank enough alcohol to the point where it almost killed me. It broke me at a, such a deep and fundamental spiritual level that I just came away from that experience with no hope whatsoever. So I meet this girl that I'm working with in this office where I got a job, and we went out to lunch one day, and we're kind of sharing our backgrounds with each other, and she told me that she hadn't partied in 3.5 years, and I said, you know, I was just totally blown away. And up to this point, nobody had ever said the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I find that absolutely amazing. Like, nobody ever suggested that I should go to a meeting or read a book or do anything like that. And so this friend of mine, Hillary, she says, well, you know, I belong to this group, and why don't we get together Sunday and we'll grab a bite to eat and I'll take you over to this meeting and I'll introduce you to a bunch of people and they can kind of, you know, show you what we do. And I said, well, that'd be awesome. So, you know, I got all excited, and like 4 days later on a Sunday afternoon, I met her and we went and grabbed a quick bite to eat. You know, I thought I was going out on a date, so I was really excited. And she takes me to my first meeting at Cedars-Sinai Hospital on Sunday nights, the Sundowners meeting at 6 p.m. And she walked me up the long stairway in the front of the Thalians Center at Cedars-Sinai, and they walked me in, and there were three old guys standing at the door, and she walked me up to them and said, here, this is Ken, he's new, take care of him. And she walked away, and I always laugh about that now because I had no idea what was happening to me, and I just been thoroughly 12-stepped and lovingly brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I believe that for me, it wasn't that weird when I look back on it. I think that I was so angry and so defiant and so hopeless that if it had gone any other way for me, other than exactly the way it did, I wouldn't be here with you today. And I really believe it was the hand of God that was guiding me in the direction. I believe it was the love that Hillary showed me by knowing exactly what it was I needed that brought me to you. And I can tell you that once I got here, I loved it. I didn't have the experience a lot of people have where they fight it and they don't want to be here and they're angry and they don't want to listen. And that's just, you know, I hear that a lot and I totally get it, but it wasn't my experience. And I listened to the speaker at my first meeting and I listened closely throughout the meeting, and there was just something about it that made sense. And for the first time in like 12 years, my life made sense. I wasn't the square peg in the round hole, right? I wasn't the one that was worrying about, I just felt at ease, and the laughter of everybody in the room and how happy everybody was. I felt like I was in the land of misfit toys, and I had finally found my home, my people, my tribe, whatever you want to call it, right? And I just clicked in. And at that end of that first meeting, one of those old timers came up to me at the end and I said, well, that was all well and good, but what do I do now? Right? I mean, I'm really happy and this was a great meeting, but what do I do when I go home? Right? How do I get from point A to point B? And they said, well, the first thing is we don't drink or use no matter what. And I said, you know what? I can't do that. I don't think I can do that. I can't promise anybody anything like that. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know who I'm going to run into. I don't know how I'm going to not do that, right? Because it had been calling me, right? I was so miserable being sober those first few months because I knew where I was going to end up eventually, right? And now I had been in this meeting and I started to hear some semblance of a solution, but I was terrified. I was terrified to leave. And I didn't want to leave. And he says, well, okay, you don't have to make us any promises, but can you meet me at this other meeting tomorrow and just not have a drink between now and then? And I said, yeah, I think I can do that. And that's how it was. I had to show up every day saying, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how to do this. I don't know what this means. I don't know what God is. I don't know. Right? And I think that that is one of the key factors and the reason that for 32 years I've never found a need to take another drink, because I showed up and I kind of just went along with the guys that seemed to be doing this successfully, right? People showed me the way, and I just did what they did. And they said, Ken, you got to get commitments, and you got to have regular meetings, and you got to get a book, and you got to get a meeting director, and you got to get a sponsor, and you got to start doing the things we do around here, and you got to show up early and stay late. You got to meet people. Always know, every time you leave a meeting, always know where your next meeting is. And never leave a meeting without 3 phone numbers from other people in the group, right? And you just remember, this was the old days, right? There were no cell phones, right? And you didn't have a pager because you didn't want to look like a drug dealer, right? So, like, when, you know, my first sponsor, I actually had a phone number and I had to call at a predetermined date and time every week. And that was how I communicated with my sponsor. There's no texting or email or, you know, FaceTime or anything else, right? It was, you had to show up. Showing up was everything. And if you showed up, then you were shown how to take the next step and shown the next indicated action. And you always knew that there were going to be a group of people where you showed up that were going to be just like you. And that somebody somewhere in one of the groups had some sort of an idea of where to point you. You know, so I've only got about 5 or 10 minutes left, and I do want to talk about, you know, while getting here was a great thing, staying here has been the best thing. And I could tell you about my first 2 or 3 years of sobriety and all the mistakes I made by not listening to my sponsor and doing a 4-step that was just a list of all the things I thought I had ever done wrong, and making amends by just trying to say I'm sorry, and, you know, just doing all the things that we do sometimes the first time through. And I made a lot of mistakes, but then at 5 years sober, I was lucky enough to find somebody who really knew the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and actually sat me down and had her read it. And we went through the book line by line, and we talked about every piece and every word, and I had a dictionary, I had to look up words, and I had to write about every step. You know, some people say you don't have to write about the first 2 steps. And my experience is that unless you're putting a pen to paper, you're not having the spiritual experience that Bill intended for us to have. And so, you know, my life changed dramatically, and I went on, you know, I met my wife, and we went on to have 3 kids, and I can say today I have an 18-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old son and a 14-year-old son that I've never seen drunk, and I have an incredibly successful life and a good career. But, you know, I know there's a lot of new people in the room, but there tends to be at least one old-timer who's sitting in silent desperation who went through what I went through from about 18 years sober to about 22 years sober, and that is, you know, we get focused and busy with other things. And I had a period of time where I got really convinced I needed to be a good father, and I needed to be a good member of my church, and I needed to be a good boss to my employees, and I needed to be a good employee to the people that hired me, and I put a lot of time and effort into being a good husband to my wife, and somehow recovery got pushed down to about 8th on the priority list, and I started having problems again, and that feeling of pending doom came back. And I was once again living that life where I felt like I was in a trap I couldn't spring, and the silent desperation that permeated my life came back. And you know, I was doing a lot of really good things. I had what I thought was a spiritual practice. I prayed, I meditated, I went to church. I was a good member of my church. I did a lot of volunteer work. You know, I was building homes with Habitat for Humanity, and I was, you know, doing all kinds of things that kept me saying to myself that I was being of service to other people. And it looked really good. A lot of people were impressed by how much I was doing and accomplishing. And what eventually happened was my marriage failed. My business blew up, because I couldn't sustain the level of activity, right? The people that in my church that I thought were all had my back, all kind of, you know, turned on me after this, all these things started falling apart. The financial crisis of 2008, 2009 was brutal for me. And, when I found myself, you know, laying in bed, you know, wanting to put a bullet in my head because I just couldn't take the level of quiet desperation I was suffering from. And then I went on a retreat, and long story short, three of the guys in my 8-man group on this retreat were long-term sober, and I shared some things that got them really concerned, and they scooped me up after that retreat, and they got me back going to meetings, and they got me working with newcomers, and they got me reading the book, and they forced me to get a new sponsor, and I knew what to do. I had a playbook. I knew how the playbook ran, and I knew exactly what to do. I needed to show up again. I needed to take all the steps that I had been shown many years ago to take. And the one thing that was different that I learned when I look back on it all now is that I may have been service to my wife, and I may have been of service to my kids, and I may have been of service to my church. But what I wasn't doing is I wasn't participating fully in the three legs of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't being of service to another alcoholic. And I love that in the beginning of your meeting, you read the chapter 7 part where it says nothing ensures us like from, you know, alcoholic destruction like working with other alcoholics. And that's absolutely my experience. And I can tell you that since I went through that 4 or 5 year period, I was so busy. Check this out. I was telling myself, I was so busy, I never took a 20-year cake. 20 years of sobriety, I didn't need to go to a meeting and take a cake. You know, I find that absolutely amazing today when I look back on it, because I would never let that happen again. And my rationale was, oh, nobody wants to hear from me. You know, nobody, you know, I'm just this, I have nothing to offer anybody. And, you know, just the fact that I was sober and the program had worked for me for a long time was enough of a reason for me to show up and take that cake for a newcomer. So I've never made that mistake again, and I've been going to meetings and participating in the program regularly ever since. And I can tell you that the greatest joy of my life today is working with another man in Alcoholics Anonymous, taking through the book and showing him what was so freely given to me, and watching his lights come on, and watching his life turn around, and watching his life get better. And I can tell you that if you're an alcoholic and you're in this meeting tonight, no matter how many days you have, I don't care if you have 3 days or 32 days or 32 months or 32 years, I'm here to tell you that if you work with another alcoholic, your life will get better. If you work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor, your life will get better. If you give away the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to somebody who needs it desperately, your life will get better. And that's just the great truth of my life. And I don't know how to explain why that guy didn't pull the trigger and blow my head off back in 1988. I don't know why that didn't happen. And I don't know why I was scooped up by those guys in that retreat and brought back to the program. All I know is that I have a duty and obligation today to show up for other alcoholics and give back what was so freely given to me. And if I don't, I'm damned. And if I do, I have a life that's just indescribably wonderful. I get to do things and see things and that just warm my heart and fill my life every day. And I just feel like the luckiest guy in the world sometimes. So I think that's all about all I got for tonight. Thanks a lot for letting me be here. My name is Kevin. I'm an alcoholic.